You're listening to the IC Interviews from Investors Chronicle. I'm Lenora Walters, and today I'm speaking to Nick Train, manager of global and UK equities funds, including Finsbury Growth and Income Trust and Ella Flintle Train UK Equity. Over the 30 years that Mr. Train has worked in investment management, he has delivered outstanding returns with the funds he runs, including those managed by the investment firm he co-founded in 2000, Flintle Train Limited. Mr. Train and his colleagues' investment approach has been likened to that of high-profile US investor Warren Buffett, because they build concentrated portfolios of financially strong, large global companies, which they rarely trade. Many of these fall into the consumer-branded goods sector and internet media and software, pharmaceuticals and financials companies also feature. So, Nick, one of your core investment beliefs is that concentration can reduce risks. So your funds tend to have far fewer holdings than many of their peers. But this goes against the view of many investment analysts, wealth managers, etc. But you reduce risk by diversifying across many holdings. So why do you take this view?
Partly it's a recognition of authority, as we might regard authority. And what I mean by that is, we've always been, Michael Flintle and I, well, for as long as Flintle Train has lasted, which is 20 years or more, and actually prior to setting up the company, we've always been enormously influenced by Berkshire Hathaway. So by Buffett and Munger. And, you know, famously, they've always argued for using the hackneyed phrase, but I think there's a value to the phrase. They've always argued for having a few eggs in your basket and watching those eggs very, very closely. That owning a few things that you at least have confidence in yourself that you understand, and where you're confident in the resilience of what you're invested in, that is less risky than owning a wider range of assets or securities where you have much lower levels of confidence, both in your understanding of the asset, but even in the sustainability of the underlying asset. Munger famously said that he thought that, I don't know, an institution like Harvard with its endowment should probably only own 8 shares in 8 great global businesses. You know, he said, you know, that would be perfectly sufficient to protect the endowment, and it would also dramatically reduce the complexity of the endowment's portfolio and portfolio strategy. So if I might say, to us the absolute essence of what we do across all of our portfolios is to own what other people sometimes regard as very substantial holdings, big holdings, which people perceive carry risk because the portfolios, as you remark, have relatively few holdings. But our attempt is to have big holdings in inherently very, very predictable, low-risk companies. That's the absolute essence of the effect we're trying to capture, to have big holdings, but in very, very substantive, reliable assets. And from our perspective, you know, I don't know. I mean, the biggest holding we have in the open-ended fund at the moment is Unilever. Which also happens to be the biggest company quoted on the UK stock exchange. Now, you know, every company, there is some risk attendant to it. But I think most dispassionate people would say, yeah, you know, Unilever, which has got, you know, the best part of a century of history and incredible predictability and resilience and diversification by product and brand around the world, that's not inherently a very risky investment. And it's, you know, not every company we own is a Unilever, but it's that effect that we're looking to capture.
These companies, you describe these companies that you target as exceptional, durable, cash generative companies. So just getting more into the specifics, what's your definition of an exceptional company, that meets your criteria? And are there any companies that maybe have some of these attributes that don't meet your criteria?
We are somewhat unusual in our interest in longevity of not just companies, but actually it's the underlying brands and business franchises. We're fascinated by brands and franchises that have endured for decades, and in some cases, things we own have endured for centuries. That ability to remain relevant or beloved to consumers or users, that strikes us as being important.
You've been adding Experian to the funds you run. What in particular about this company meets your criteria? Why add it now?
I think the absolute nub of this is at the margin for our portfolios, we're comfortable. We're more than comfortable. We're very happy with the shape of how we are invested for our clients currently. But at the margin, we would like to increase our exposure to two types of company. This is in a UK context. Would like to increase our exposure, first of all, to companies with a high proportion of their sales coming from luxury or premium goods and services. We're persuaded that over the next 10 or 15 years, luxury, premium, aspirational products are going to be more and more sought after by consumers. Now, sorry, that's not Experian, obviously, but I just wanted to put it into context of what we're doing at the margin of our portfolio. The other thing that we want to do for our portfolios is at the margin, increase the exposure we have to substantive UK companies doing something important with digital technology. And you know, RELX and actually the London Stock Exchange are doing very, very important things with data and digital services and artificial intelligence currently. But Experian is another major UK company. It's a £27 billion company that is doing something with digital data and software services that is materially increasing the value of its products and services for its customers.
We've obviously been in fairly unprecedented circumstances over the past few months. So in terms of your investment process, which is fairly established, have you had to modify it or consider any new things, when selecting an investment, in view of, I suppose, the way the world's changed recently?
The underlying thematic ideas haven't changed. If anything, I think our confidence, if that's the right word, in those thematic drivers of investment returns have been reinforced by what's happened in 2020. I think it, for investors like us in beloved consumer brands, seeing the business performance of Dove soap, or the business performance of Cadbury chocolate, or the business performance of, to pick a much smaller brand, Carex, for instance, you know, the hand sanitizer. I mean, Carex is owned by a relatively small UK company, PZ Cousins. That's had an incredible response to the circumstances we find ourselves in this year. The value of trusted and beloved consumer brands has gone up materially, in our opinion, in 2020, because consumers have flocked to such beloved and trusted brands. As we get deeper into the 21st century, it becomes clear that in the 20th century, growth involved physical capital. You know, if you grew, you had to open a new shop, or you had to lay down another railway track, or you had to open a new factory. Your growth was expensive because growth required significant amounts of literal physical capital to drive that growth. By contrast, it does look a sustainable proposition that in the 21st century, growth is much less capital intensive. Digital makes growth almost virtual. The first thing it does is that produces intrinsically higher returns to capital than and to equity than were possible in the 20th century. And in turn, those higher returns to capital, because there's much less capital required for growth, deserve higher valuations. And I do observe us being willing to pay higher valuations for businesses that interest us than Michael Linsall and I might have done, let's say, back in the year 2000.
I mean, on the subject of, I suppose, exploiting digitalization technology, your funds hold education product provider Pearson. But in one of your recent fund commentaries, you said it hasn't yet been able to prove whether tech will ultimately be a disruptor or an enhancer to its business model and market position. So why do you continue to hold Pearson?
In order to have the mindset, yeah, the attitude that allows you to hold an investment for as long as we've held a winner like the London Stock Exchange, the flip side of that is you've got to hold everything for a long period of time. You can't just choose to run your great successes, because you never know whether they're going to carry on being a success. You either have a strategy that says, I'm going to be a long-term holder of a company, almost whatever the share price does. I'm just going to be disciplined and stick to an idea until it definitively has proven to be wrong. Our position, for good or for ill, is we've said we are long-term strategic investors. We'll take the rough with the smooth, but we think that if we hold for long periods of time, that gives us the best chance of success. And so the reason that we still own Pearson is exactly the reason that we still own the London Stock Exchange, because it's simply a reflection of the decision we've taken about how to approach the investment challenge. I wish Pearson had been a massive success over the last 10 or 12 years. I mean, it's turned out not to be, but holding it has been consistent with what we've always said that we would do. I do think it's also fair, just to add to this, though, I think it is evident that the prize to any company that does work out a way to deliver educational services digitally, and particularly if they can begin to do that globally, that the reward for that could be very, very high indeed. And we have always thought and frankly continue to think that Pearson, that is still an opportunity that this company has. Or putting it another way, there's no other company that has taken that opportunity away from Pearson. It's still absolutely, to use the cliche, in the game.
I mean, just in terms of, I suppose, on the flip side, the sort of selling, I mean, what would make you sell one of your holdings?
We hate selling. I think selling anything is an admission that you've made a mistake. And although we do make mistakes, you know, we try and avoid making them. I think people sell things far too often. And so we prefer to, you know, to sometimes grit our teeth, you know, and try and maintain the discipline of having a concentrated portfolio of what you think are outstanding franchises and recognizing that they will go through tough times, but just saying that's an opportunity to add to what you thought was a wonderful asset. On the rare occasions that we've sold, it's tended to be either because often technology has just clearly obliterated the investment case for a franchise. Also, sometimes very rarely, companies can take decisions about their balance sheet. Companies can take decisions about borrowing that strikes us as being imprudent. And we have, over the last few years, occasionally sold out of companies where we felt that their tolerance for debt had got higher than we were comfortable with.
Hmm. And what was your most recent disposal?
I struggle to recall, actually. I mean, we've lost a couple of things to takeover over the last few years. This is going to seem convoluted, but actually it does slightly fit the criteria I've been talking about. Long ago, we had a massive holding in Cadbury. And our massive holding in Cadbury turned into two holdings. Mondelez, which we still own, which is the business that owns Cadbury, as you probably know. But it also turned into a smaller holding in Kraft Heinz. And then there was a demerger, blah, 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 blah. But anyway, we had a holding in Kraft Heinz that we'd inherited out of Cadbury. And that was an asset that we sold out of completely because we thought the debt was worryingly high in that company. And that was a reason to sell.
Okay. Just turning to another of your key investment beliefs, that's on dividends. And you say that you believe dividends matter. Why do you believe dividends matter so much? And in view of all the recent cuts and suspensions in the UK market, can you still consider this as such an important factor?
If you look back over decades, companies that have turned out to be fabulous investments, and again, I'm not talking about 2 years, I'm not even talking about 5 years, I'm talking about, we're interested in finding companies that, you know, for 30 years, for the next 30 years, are going to turn out to be fantastic investments. But that's the way we're thinking about allocating capital. On a post-hoc basis, when you look back over the last 30 years or the last 50 years, often companies that have turned out to be wonderful, wonderful long-term investments have also, and let's even say this word deliberately, have also coincidentally turned out to be businesses that have been able to grow their dividends materially over time as well. It's not an absolute 100% correlation, but it's not a bad correlation. Companies that have had phenomenal capital returns over multiple decades tend also, not in every case, but they often tend also to have got very strong dividend histories over the same period. And I think that's as far as I would like to go in this claim that, that dividends and dividend histories are important to us. But I also acknowledge, and maybe this is somewhere where our thinking may have to change a bit, I also acknowledge that some companies can get into a rut of over distributing dividends. And if they do, then it's much, much better for the company and for the owners of the companies over time that companies acknowledge that. And as we have seen in 2020, dividends being suspended or cut. I mean, that's not a bad thing.
I mean, do you place some, you know, equal importance on holding companies which pay dividends across all your funds?
I would say that across all of our funds, it's important to us to own businesses that have the potential to generate excess cash over time, and that that cash could be returned to owners as dividends or share buybacks over time. I think for us, and this is by, you know, there are other people with different approaches, and I'm not saying those approaches are not valid. They are. But for us, owning a business where we simply couldn't conceive that there could ever be a dividend flow or a share buyback return, we would be unlikely to invest in a company like that, because it would seem overly speculative to us.
Okay, now thinking specifically about your UK funds, obviously the UK market's been very challenged in some of those respects over the past few months, but you hold some overseas listed stocks. Would you consider increasing the UK funds overseas allocation to UK stocks in view of problems like, dividend drought, and I suppose the fact that UK, equities have not had a good time recently?
The answer is a profound and committed double no to the question. And the reason why I would say so robustly, I would say no to that question is, first, and this is a more trivial point, but I'll make it nonetheless. We are relatively close to our permitted maximum in non-UK equities. You know, we're allowed to have up to 20%. In non-UK equities, we're at about 18 at the moment. So there just actually today isn't a great deal of room for us to add more non-UK equities. So that's one reason why we won't do any more. But the second reason, and the much, much more substantive reason, is I am a believer. I'm a partial believer in this, or I'm a prejudiced believer in this, but I think that the UK equity market is really unreasonably undervalued relative to global peers currently. And if anything, I would rather be increasing my exposure to UK equities right now than reducing them.
Okay, thank you, Nick. A really helpful update on your funds and some very interesting points for investors to consider.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.